This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features director of photography Craig Robleski, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC about his work on the television series Fargo and the film In the Tall Grass. This interview was recorded on September 9th, 2018.
We're with Craig Robleski.
That's right.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, you nailed it.
CSC, and we're in Toronto just having a little conversation. I'd like to congratulate you on your the TV series award you got this year at the CSC Awards for Fargo.
It's a great honor.
Yeah, that was fun. It was good that you were in town, too.
Oh, yeah, I was really lucky. I've only been able to attend two of the award shows, but it's always been a good time.
So for some of our people, like where did you start? Where did you go to film school? Where are you based out of?
I'm based out of Calgary. I live just south of Calgary in the foothills. Got 5 acres of land and some dogs and a long-suffering wife. I've lived there my whole career, and I've been lucky. In a lot of ways, I've been lucky to be there because you don't get pigeonholed in Calgary. You know, like it's an industry that's, everyone does a bit of everything. So, you know, I've, over the course of my career, I've been able to do like everything, documentaries, commercials, music videos, music projects.
So were you born in Alberta?
No, I was born in Winnipeg,
so
lived most of my life in Alberta.
Right, so you're a prairie boy.
More or less, yeah. I would say so.
Did you go to film school, or how did you get started?
Well, I really wanted to get into radio, believe it or not. And I went to Mount Royal College in Calgary, which is now Mount Royal University. And the first year of the program was radio and the second year was TV. I thought maybe I would take the first, because I really had no interest in TV, like honestly, no interest in it at all. I only took it for the radio program. And I took the radio program and I realized I didn't actually like radio and I didn't think there was any real, you know, longevity in it. I thought, that's not what I want to do. And then I thought, okay, I wasn't sure what I was going to do then, because I thought, well, that's, radio was what I wanted to do, and I was kind of at sea. And then they had a introduction to TV program at the end of the first year, just as kind of a introduction to the idea of what your second year is going to be like. So I remember, you know, going through the week, it was a week long session, and, you know, I was learning about TV and okay, whatever. And then they had a day, and I remember this so vividly, there was a day when we all went into the studio and they had a camera on a tripod set up in the middle of the studio, and it was like introduction to the camera. Here's the camera. So the instructor, you know, panned and tilt, and he was like zooming, and he's like, here's, you know, give it a try. So we all stood in line. It's like we're at a bank or something. We're all just like standing in line waiting for our turn to play with the camera. And I was in line and I was sort of like, you know, mildly interested. And I remember this so vividly, that I stepped up to the camera, and as soon as I put my hands on it, I felt like I knew what to do with it. It was the weirdest thing. Like, I went from having virtually no interest in cameras to being like a wholesale obsession in the space of like 2 steps, where I, you know, when I was the next person in line, I was like, but after I touched it, I'm like, okay, I want to learn more about this, and this is what I want to do. Like, it was just amazing.
That's fate.
It was fate.
So where did you take it from there? Like, you just focused the rest of your schooling on that? Or?
Yeah, I just basically became the guy who wanted to shoot everything that everybody was doing. and I spent, I was always going up to my classmates and saying, if you need somebody who shoots your stuff, just let me know. And, you know, and obviously I couldn't shoot everything. But I just put a huge amount of energy into just getting as much time with it as I could and trying to learn about it. But it was an odd thing. I mean, here almost 30 years later, it's the same thing. I'm still trying to figure it out.
So what was your first, paying gig?
Actually, there was a woman named Kathy Archibald there was a program that was running at SAIT, which is the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, which had it was called the Professional Motion Picture Production Program. And it was where people who had some experience could go to school to kind of polish up their experience and their education and then also get to make a film. And Kathy Archibald was one of the students in this program, and she, I don't even know how we met, but she got in touch with me and said she wanted to do some documentary projects. That was kind of my first paying gig, and we got along really well. We ended up doing a whole bunch of projects together. She did this documentary about this ice cream shop, in a neighborhood called Bridgeland, which is the neighborhood I ultimately ended up living in. But we did these little documentaries, and it was really formative because she just let me do my thing, which I didn't even know what my thing was. I was still figuring it out. But it was really creative, and it was really fun. We ended up shooting at one on 16mm film, which, you know, I didn't take any film training at school. I just sort of figured it out, you know, read a lot of cinematography books and magazines and kind of learned as much as I could and just shot stuff and made a lot of mistakes. And ultimately, Kathy and I did a lot of work together, and that was kind of how it all got started.
So documentary is kind of like the first projects you've worked
mm-hmm.
on. And how did that evolve into, when was your first opportunity for a dramatic or a feature?
A dramatic work largely came from, I did some camera assisting on like student films and indie projects and that kind of thing. Again, largely learning film on set. Like, I didn't learn any film techniques in terms of cameras or anything other than by just doing it. You know, I remember a guy got a call for a camera assistant job. This was years ago. And they called, and I was broke. Like, I had no money. It was almost Christmas. I remember I was at this Christmas party, and this was all pre-cell phone. So I think the Christmas party was at my house. And I was just almost, like, I was wondering what I was going to do for rent next month. And I got a call, and they said, hey, you want to come do a camera assistant on this this figure skating show? Or it was like a figure skating special. And I'm like, yes, please. And they said, have you worked with the Arri SR2? And I'm like, oh, yeah. And I'd never touched an Arri SR2. Like, they had the SR1 at the film school, and that's what we were using. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you bet. No problem. And then I didn't know anything about it. And then when I went to do the job, they said, okay, well, here's your camera package. Or they said, you'll get your camera package in the morning. And I said, well, is it possible for me to get it tonight? Because I'd really like to just prep it and go through it. And what I really wanted to do was go and take it in my motel room and learn how to use it. Because I literally I never put hands on one. But I, you know, it said, oh, yeah, I really want to prep it and just make sure it's, you know, blah, blah. It sounded all very professional. But what I really wanted to do was actually learn, you know, with my SR2 book that I borrowed from a friend and actually figure out how to use this thing.
Did they get it to you?
Yeah. And I spent, like, the whole night just tearing this thing apart in my motel room and figuring it out. And, you know, just practicing loading mags on dummy rolls and just making sure that I didn't embarrass myself the next morning. And
well, at least the SRs are easy to load.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it wasn't like Aaron Eclair or something. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've admittedly sucked my neck out a lot just, you know, saying I know how to do things when I didn't know how to do it and then figuring it out, which I think everyone's career in cinematography is somewhat built on that because...
Yeah, you got to sink or swim.
Yeah, exactly.
So now you're shooting much bigger things. Obviously, you got yourself first in film. How was your transition from film to digital? How did you feel about that?
Well, I did a lot of digital work. I mean, I kind of started out in digital, like in television, and then got into film. And I always did both. Like, I've always, you know, when I started doing commercials and music videos, we shot those on film, but I'd be doing documentaries and corporate projects on digital, you know, back on Betacam days or the F900s or the Varicams. So there was always those two worlds kind of working alongside each other. So when digital came along, I was really comfortable with the transition. You know, back when we started shooting on F900s, those were just like a hot-rodded Betacam to me. So, like, I already knew what that tool was, and I was able to transition quite easily between the drama world that I've been working in and dovetailing it with the digital world that I've been working in on documentaries, and then allowing that technology to inform the other. So it was a fairly easy transition, really.
Was there a feature project that you did early in your career that was any kind of anecdote that happened that made you realize that, or reconfirmed that this is what you want to do, or there was something that horribly that went wrong? You know, something that you learned, like, was there one that just, like, the light bulb went off?
Well, there's been a bunch of them, I guess, but one of the first dramatic projects I did that really stuck with me was I did a little short called Game 7 with a director named Ando Lecter, who lives in Calgary. And he wrote this script, and it was about this kid who was trying to listen to Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals on the radio, and his radio kept crapping out, and he kept losing the signal, and he was riding around on his bike trying to find the signal, and he ends up, you know, stumbling on a house that has a TV in it that a guy's watching the game, and he's like, you know, it was a cute little film about this adventure trying to find the Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final. And it was the first film where I sort of realized how much I love telling stories and how much I loved using the camera to tell those stories and really implementing the tools in a way that supports the story, you know, because when you start out, you know, you generally it's like you want to make pretty pictures and you want to make things beautiful and you're kind of like emptying the truck on every shot with all your techniques and, you know, and then as you get more experienced and mature, you realize that restraint is important and you start realizing that these tools are very powerful and that you can use them very specifically. And there's not good or bad, there's only right or wrong, you know, in terms of what tools you're going to use. That's the film where I kind of realized like, wow, okay, like you can do very little and still have it be powerful. You don't have to, you know, hit this snail in the head that hard, or you don't have to have your fingerprints all over it. You can take a very restrained approach and a very simple approach mm-hmm. and still tell the story well. And it was very liberating. And it was also a project where I think I realized, and this was a pretty important revelation, and this is important to young filmmakers, especially now with technology, is that we own the equipment, it doesn't own us. You know, like I remember vividly that realization where I was sort of scared of the gear, but it's inanimate, you know, it can't hurt you. It's, you own it, you own what, you know, you control what it does, it doesn't control you. And it sounds like an obvious realization, but when you're first starting out, I think there's a tendency to be intimidated by the equipment and feel like that it somehow can work against you, but it's only going to do what you want it to do. It's, I mean, obviously, if you're not adept with the equipment and you're not experienced with it, that is an obvious connection. But it's an important realization, I think, for young filmmakers to realize that the equipment is not the driving factor, you know, their tools. I just find that the older I get, the less I want to do. And it's not out of laziness or anything. It's just out of, you just want to do, just to capture the essence of it. You don't want to inflict yourself on it. You don't want to have what you're doing overpower the story. You just want to support it. I mean, I think Roger Deakins is the sort of gold standard for someone who doesn't inflict himself on a project, who just does what's necessary and nothing more.
That's a good lead into just, you know, how you approach a project. Like when you first read a script, are you seeing something right away, or do you try and just look at the narrative and then what is your process?
Firstly, I always try to clear my head. Like I try to not bring baggage to a project. I mean, obviously you can't help but bring all your experience to it, which is a good thing. But the risk of bringing your experience to it is that you bring preconceived notions and you bring Craig Wroblewski of it all to it. Which is, you know, it's not what I want to do, you know what I mean? Like, I would rather approach it for what it is and approach it with clear eyes and a fresh mind. And to that end, I always read a script. I never want to read a script at a time when I can't read the whole thing. I don't want to read it in pieces, and I don't want to read it in a distracted environment. Like, planes and places like that are perfect places to read scripts because you just... you know, that's all you're there to do. So getting that first read is so critical. And I always try to do the first read and not make notes on the first read. And certainly images come into my head, but I'm careful to not get attached to them to the extent that I don't write them down. Because if you make a note, then it's like there's a sort of obligation to pursue that idea. And I would rather just read the script first time as a viewer or as an audience member. And then the second pass, if the idea comes back and it sticks, then maybe it has some resonance. But if the idea was fleeting and also might be a knee-jerk instinctive thing, it's like, oh, that's, you know, it's a hospital scene, so let's do this. It's like, well, no, hang on. Maybe that's what you did on the last hospital scene. That's why you're thinking that. Maybe it's better to just read it again. Let it sink in. Let it cook in your subconscious for a bit. And then come back to it and say, okay, what can we do with this?
Well, then you have the collaboration of course, the director mm-hmm. and the producers that may have some preconceived ideas as well.
Of course, yeah.
And then everybody is open
yeah.
to all the transformations.
Yeah, well, and you hope that there's, you know, if it's working well, then you get a coming together of those ideas where it's like, oh, you know, I made the same note as the director did. Or, you know, they said, you know, let's push in here or let's do this here. And it's like same note. And you're like, okay. Good.
Yeah, you're on the sink.
Yeah, you know you're on the
sink.
Yeah.
One less little hurdle.
Whereas if, you know, I write Technocrane and he writes Handheld, it's like, okay, hang on. we need to have a chat. But yeah, I think the fresh mind thing is so critical because I don't, you know, and there's a lot of very talented cinematographers who who kind of have a thing and that's what they do. And it's always great. It's always beautiful. But I think part of the fun of the job is that rebooting your head and coming at it with and learning, because that's how you learn, right? If I just keep doing the same thing, then I'm just regurgitating.
Yeah. No, you're there to serve the narrative.
Yeah.
And the vision of the director.
Yeah. And I like challenging myself. It's stressful, when you basically throw everything out and say, I'm going to start from scratch. I'm going to test lenses. I'm going to test filters and come up with a new combination. It'd be easier to just say, well, I'm just going to, use this combination that I've used before. And sometimes it ends up being that, but I like going down the road and I like, seeing, and there's so many possibilities now and opportunities and gear. It's like, you want to try these things out and see. Like, I used to shoot a lot of commercials and that was a great place to test gear. It's like, well, let's try this tool out. But on long form, it's a little more difficult. You can't just sort of be throwing stuff at the wall.
Yeah,
so
doing 40 takes or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotta make our day.
Yeah. So, I like the testing process. I just like learning about things. And then, you also get the input of your collaborators. It's like, hey, what do you know? What have you seen?
Yeah, your influence. You have to be flexible, because what's the point? If you're going in with it's like an actor, if they're just doing their thing in every film, you're just hiring that person to do that.
Yeah.
Nothing else. And I mean, I think any skilled cinematographer can shoot anything, and I think it's very wrong for people to pigeonhole that DP just because they just happen to do a lot of, drama or a lot of horror, but they should be able to do anything.
It's a natural tendency,
yeah.
for human beings to want to kind of put people into boxes and say, like, okay, this is... he's the horror guy or he's the comedy guy or whatever. But I don't think there's a cinematographer alive that doesn't feel they can do any genre. They just need to figure it out, That's the fun of it.
What motivates your lighting? Like, when you do go to a location, you've had all the prep and, creative discussions.
Well, I always start from a place of tone. Tone is really critical to me in terms of where the character's at, where's the story at, what's the arc of the visuals. Tone is so critical. And that's why I enjoyed Fargo so much, because that show is all about tone. I found Fargo very enjoyable because the tone is so obvious and so burned into the material that it was a pleasure finding it and implementing it. Some projects are more difficult, but I always start from a place of tone. And you always want to think, okay, what can you do with the look that supports where you're at? Because, the reality is if you light everything dark, then, like, if you do everything the same all the time, you lose the ability to create that modulation, which is where the tone comes in, where, like, sometimes you want to light something bright, even though it might technically be ugly and might not be photographically the most appealing thing, but sometimes it's right. And that also gives you the license to do other things, like we've been on the project I'm currently shooting, In the Tall Grass, it's a supernatural story in a natural setting. And one of the things that the director and I discussed was that the film either needs to be natural or supernatural. If we start getting into that muddy middle ground, where we're kind of leaning into little horror tropes and things where we start to tip our hand, it feels like it muddies the film. So, when we've gone supernatural, Like, it is,
No question.
Yeah, there's no question. But, and the rest of it, it felt like it had to be very natural so that it gave us the license and the jumping off point to be supernatural.
Nice.
Whereas if we were in that middle ground, then we're just taking a half step,
Mm-hmm.
And so those sorts of things where you have to give yourself room to tell the story. And if you just sort of, like we talked about earlier, if you're just kind of emptying the truck on every setup and everything is super glitzy and super, sometimes beautiful is not enough, if everything's pretty all the time, it doesn't really mean anything,
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a cinematographer, I shouldn't be saying that, but it's sometimes things shouldn't be beautiful. Sometimes you need to create things that aren't beautiful. But I see, there's a tendency, especially with technology, to make everything really pretty all the time, because you can. Like, it doesn't take much, to get a really beautiful image. And you see it in still photography all the time, where you see these images that are beautiful and technically perfect, but they're kind of soulless. And there's, and it's like, what more? There's got to be something more, you know.
Soulless, yeah, that's a good
yeah.
point. It's like,
and it always, I mean, I'm obsessed with J.M.W. Turner, the painter, because he was basically an impressionist before there was impressionists. And he, if you look at his early paintings, they are technically perfect. Like, he created hyper-real visions of life in England that are just like, they're like photographs. And then he just threw it all away, and he went in search of the sublime. He basically was trying to find the next thing, like, what is there beyond reality and presenting reality? He was trying to present what it felt like to be in that place, not what it looked like to be in that place. And that's my thing with my job, is I'm trying to make people feel like they're there. I just want it to look like we're there. It needs to feel like we're there. Yeah. And that's why I like these larger formats. Like, we're shooting, you know, we shot the 65, the Alexa 65 on Umbrella Academy, and we shot the LF in the tall grass. And they're immersive formats, and they make you feel like you're there. It was a life changer for me, like, in terms of my job, to see these formats, and you feel like, oh my God, you're there. Like, it's like us having this conversation, and all of a sudden you feel like you're sitting across the room from that person. And you're having this conversation. It's incredible.
So you had not shot in 65.
I hadn't shot the 65 before.
So that was the first time was the Umbrella mm-hmm. Academy.
Yeah. And it's just...
yeah. I mean, I guess
it just reboots your whole mindset about how to use the camera. Because it's actually like being there. And when you move that camera past an object, it feels like it feels when you move past an object when you're walking. Like, it's the strangest. It's hard to quantify. It's like 3D. But better than 3D. It's like real 3D.
And so are you feeling this when you're looking at the monitor on set, or when you're looking at rushes? Like, at what point?
It's when on set, when you're looking at the monitor and you see an object moving. Like, I became obsessed with moving that camera through space, because the way things felt when you moved past them was just, it felt so real, and it felt like you were actually there experiencing it. It was revelatory. Like, I was like, it just blew my mind.
And then in the tall grass, it was shot in...
On the LF. Yeah, which is a smaller sensor than the 65. It's the large format sensor. And that's the word for it. It is immersive. Like, it, you know, I can't imagine shooting... Because in the tall grass literally takes place in the tall grass. Like, 80% of the film is in this 8 to 10 foot high grass. And if we'd have shot it on a conventional format, it would have felt two-dimensional. It would have felt like you have the person and you have the grass, and those two elements are kind of separated. But with the LF, you just feel the environment, and you put them in there, and it's just really remarkable.
And they would have been shot in 4K?
4.5K, yeah.
4.5.
And like Umbrella Academy was 5K, the 5K mode in the 65. The thing about the 65 and the LF is that it changes how the lenses work. You know, you have, like, essentially on the 65, if you put a 35mm lens on, it becomes the equivalent of about a 21. And if you put on a 24 lens, it becomes about the equivalent of a 14 or a 16. But the difference being, you're shooting a flatter field. So you get the field of view of the lenses. You get that wide perspective, but you don't get the bending. You know, like a 25 mil on the LF is about the equivalent of an 18, but it doesn't feel like an 18. You know, it feels like a wider version of a 25, which is part of my favorite thing about it, because I never want to feel the camera. Like, it always bothers me when you feel the camera at work.
Yeah, and if you have a wide lens of distortion, yeah, it takes you away from what's going on, because you feel as wow.
Yeah, it bumps you out of the story. All the relationships that you're accustomed to seeing with your eyes feel wrong, you know. And sometimes you can use that. Obviously, you can use wide lenses to great advantage, and a lot of filmmakers do. But if you're presenting a story that you want to feel authentic, and you can be on a wider field of view and get a field of view that's more attuned to the human eye, without feeling the lens, then I feel like you're doing something, and then I feel like you're immersing the audience. And that's one of my favorite things about these larger formats, is you don't feel the lens. You just feel like you're there.
Well, that's interesting. Is there anything in your own personal kit, like what you don't go to set without? It's not light meters anymore, unless you still use a light meter.
I still use a light meter.
You did.
I still always have my meter there. I don't use it as much as I used to, but on this show I've been using it, because I found that I lost some of the discipline of maintaining ratios. And after years of shooting film, you realize, like, you used to have this all in your head about what your ratios are, where your fill levels are sitting, what your key level is. You know, with digital, it's, and with a good DIT, then the DIT's doing kind of some of that work for you, which is great, but I feel like it's a crutch, and I feel like, okay, I need to, you know, on this show I've been carrying a meter every day, because I never like technology when it's a crutch, and I feel like a lot of the technology now can easily become a crutch, and you can lose the sense of how we did things for years before this technology came along. And also there's a tendency to, and you see it on television now, where you could sort of tell that the shows are lit by the scopes, you know, where it's like all the flesh tones are sitting just a little too perfectly, the balance feels wrong, or, you know, it feels like that, you know, the flesh tones are always where flesh tones should be, and the blacks are always where blacks should be. And I think back in the day, we used to kind of put things where we wanted it to be, not where it should be. You know, and I think the technology kind of pushes you in the direction of putting it where it should be technically, but not where it necessarily should be aesthetically. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
No, it makes sense. And I was thinking as you were talking, like, how do you keep control of what you want it to look like? You know, when you have a DIT now, so they're doing stuff, I would presume, under your direction.
Yeah, the right DIT is a true collaborator. Like, yes. Gautam Pinto, who I've been working with here on Tallgrass and Umbrella Cat, he was incredible. He did The Shape of Water. Like, he's very, very talented. And he's got a great eye, and he's a storyteller. He understands what we're trying to do, you know, and he's a great sounding board. He's not afraid to say things like, do you think this is the right thing for story? You know, it's, like, really incredible. And he's a true collaborator. And you get the right DIT, and you don't have those battles of, like, you know, the DIT's trying to take things where you don't want it to be.
And all the, I mean, I think that's good tips for DITs, in the sense that, I mean, it's a technical thing. They can do all the dials, they can adjust everything, but it's about what's in the heart.
It's really important for DITs to bear in mind that their job is not just a technical one, you know. Their job is very much an aesthetic. And it's important for them to develop that side of themselves. I mean, all of them are very technically skilled. There's no two ways about it. But not all of them have invested in the kind of building their aesthetic knowledge.
I guess it would take someone that they work with to sort of open that door in their mind.
And also to take it upon themselves to, I mean, it's like cinematographers, you know, they have to build their own voice. And it's important for DITs to develop their voice on an aesthetic level as well, and not just, I mean, obviously they need to know the equipment. But it's a little too easy to just say, you know, this is where this should be, without having a knowledge of the intention behind it, you know? I mean, without sounding too glib about it, honestly, the only thing I will not go to set without is knowing what the story is. Like, that's, like, literally, I could lose my meter case, I could lose everything. As long as I knew what the story was, I could do my job. Yes. That's the most critical thing that anybody can bring to set.
That's good.
Because the rest of it is all in service of that. So if you don't come to set with an idea what the story is, then all the rest of the stuff isn't going to be as useful to you. But you need to show up every day knowing what it is you're trying to accomplish.
So where do you see yourself in 10 years? Is this something you're content to do? Is there anything, I mean, you know, when you started out, did you have any pause to go, where will I be in 10 years? This is what I want to achieve. You know, would there be anything else? Have you conquered anything else? Have you done... Is there a certain genre that you haven't done that you'd like to? Or
I came to this realization, this is going to be a sideways answer, because obviously I'm good at sideways answers, that's all I've been doing all day. But I came to this realization fairly recently that, you know, because, you know, there's moments when you get tired and, you know, you're exhausted and you kind of ask yourself why you're doing this, you know what I mean? And it's not a terrible thing, it's, you know, you need to kind of reboot yourself every once in a while. But I came to this realization recently that a huge part of the reason I do this is the connectivity. You know, the connectivity with people. Because, to be honest, the technical stuff is not the core of it. For me, it's not my core interest. They're tools, and you need to know how to use them. But the ability to use the medium and the process to connect with people is really what drives me and really what gets me going. You know, like, when you meet a group of people and they're like-minded and you can work together and you find common ground and you start collaborating, that's really energizing. And then when you can use these tools to create something that connects with an audience, that's really powerful too. And it's this kind of thread of connectivity that really has been it's been great fuel,
fuel
in the last few years. Yeah. You know, when you start working on when you, you know, my agent asked me, he said, you know, what do you want to, he asked me a similar question. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, without sounding flip, I just want to do great work with great people. And he says, well, that's not a bad answer. And it's kind of true. Like, I'm not as hung up on specific genres or styles of shooting or all that. I want to meet and connect with great people and then do great work together. And hopefully it connects with an audience so this thread of connectivity continues. Because that's really exciting. And it's quite a privilege. You know, not very few people are afforded the privilege we're afforded of connecting with people on this intense level and then having something to show for it that connects with people again. You know, when you see when a show is released and you see like the social media and you see how people become really engaged with the show and really invested in it and really care about it and really fall in love with these characters and really can't wait for the next episode, like it's really, really powerful. And it's such a rare privilege. It really is.
One final question. Now, when did you get your letters, your CSC letters? Like, when did you
From the time I was in film school, I always was mystified by these letters after people's names. I'm like, what does that mean? And so I've always admired the CSC as an organization. I've always admired CSC cinematographers and ASC cinematographers. And you're like, you know, it felt like a form of coming together of comrades, but also there's a validation in it where it's like, you know, and, you know, winning a CSC award is such a huge honor because it's your peers and it's the people who do this for a living and understand what it is you're trying to do. When they give it recognition, that's extremely, extremely flattering because it's one thing to win an award based on, you know, what is perceived as beautiful images or whatever, but when the people are in the trenches doing it, look at it and go, that's pretty good, then, you know, that's an enormous honor. I was an associate member, and then, you know, I didn't think I would get in as early as I did, but they responded to what I was doing, and there was a few projects that I was really proud of that I thought, well, I'll give this a shot and send it in and see what they think. And I remember when I got the call, I remember exactly where I was when I got the call, and it was back on my huge cell phone, like back in 2000, it's like briefcase size cell phone, and I answered. And I remember them saying, you know, they really want to see more from you, but they've accepted you, but they want to see more.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.